Well, I'm so happy the choir left. Now we can just talk frankly amongst ourselves. So we do talk about change. I know we do. And we often talk about it very glibly, as if it's the most desirable thing in the world. Oh, it's really great to change. But you know what? It's frequently not. And many times we run away from it. Because when we experience it, I mean true transformative change, the change that shakes up our lives, then sometimes it's not a welcome companion. It is, in fact, an uninvited guest. So the story I'm telling you today is absolutely true. Their sources are printed in the order of service. I can simply say that it's a story about change, and it's a story that is difficult. And that's why, to tell the story honestly, I have to use a word I don't like to use. It starts with the letter N, but nobody in America can live without it. Durham, North Carolina in the 1970s is a time of tremendous upheaval and change. Durham was known for some years as a very stable city in the South. It had a prosperous black middle class, but it had also tremendous poverty. White poverty and black poverty alike. It was a policy of the federal government to focus upon the integration of American schools by sending lots and lots of money to communities all over the United States, especially to the South, of course, to foster the possibility of integration. Best way to do that was to have dialogue, discussion. What's better than to have people who are opposed to one another come together and have a frank discussion? Maybe that's the way issues can be solved. And in the South, we're following the Civil War by some 100 years. We still experience times of tremendous segregation. Even with integration, now the law of the land, there is white flight. So white students go to private white schools only. No blacks need apply. And consequently, segregation is worse than ever in the South. Durham, North Carolina, the idea is to have people come together and to have a conversation. And what better way to have a fruitful conversation than to have the two polar opposites in the community gather for dialogue and discussion? So it becomes the bright idea of some idealist to pull together C.P. Ellis, who is the exalted cyclops of the local Ku Klux Klan, their name, not mine. The Durham, North Carolina Ku Klux Klan has the reputation of being one of the best organized in the United States. So C.P. Ellis, who is the son of Paul Ellis, an impoverished white worker in the tobacco factory who dies at the age of 48, C.P. Ellis follows his father's path in standing up for white supremacy. White supremacy is important in the South because it's viewed as the right thing to do still. I mean, we don't want black guys messing with our women. The Durham White Supremacy Club sponsors a parade float with 16 young white women dressed in white and spotting banners with the slogan, "Protect us with your vote." This volatile mixture of sexuality and politics disenfranchises and puts at risk several generations of African Americans who unfortunately live in the South. In fact, after the Civil War, African Americans in the South, former slaves, are subjected to violence without restraint. Patsy Michener, a former slave, says it this way: two snakes full of poison, slavery and freedom. Freedom following the Civil War is, for many black Americans in the South, dangerous. But let's move ahead. It's April 4, 1968. It's the day that Martin Luther King has been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. C.P. Ellis throws a party. He runs a gas station in Durham, North Carolina, and he invites all of his clan buddies to join him at the party to celebrate the fact, as he would later tell journalist Studs Terkel, really rejoicing because that son of a bitch was dead. C.P. Ellis grew up in an alcoholic family, and his own children have fared not so much better than he fared. Generations of white poverty exist in the South as well. So C.P. Ellis experiences with his kids what he experienced as the son of his father, living a life of deprivation. He dreams, like his dad did, of a better life. Which is why when he is asked to participate in this dialogue about integrating schools, Ellis reluctantly agrees to do so. Reluctantly because he's not happy to associate with Ann Atwater. Ann is his counterpart. She is an African-American woman. She's the leader in the black community. She is militant because her children also are living a life of poverty in really poor schools. So Ann Atwater stands up for the rights of African-Americans as C.P. Ellis identifies niggers as the problem. We don't have a problem with integration in our schools. The problem is niggers. Why does Ellis say yes to sitting down with Ann Atwater? Because he's a pragmatist. He wants to make sure that they don't get to ram through whatever they want. That's liberals and blacks. There's the appeal of power. He's a good organizer. And since integration is coming, and he knows it, he wants to mitigate the harmful effects that integration will have for his children. But he agrees to do so and receives death threats. Not from the black community. These are not black people calling him up. These are his buddies. You keep working with those niggers and you're going to get yourself shot. That's one of the calls. And after this goes on for a while, another phone call: I'm going to shoot you down like the dog you are, Ellis. Well, buddy, you're just going to have to get in line. The opening night of the first meeting, the dialogue on integrating Durham, North Carolina schools approaches, and the pressure on Ellis to bow out increases, not only from the Klan community, but also from civic leaders in the white community. For example, the Durham Lions Club doesn't like the idea of blacks and whites sitting down together. And in fact, the organization of the Lions Club of Durham, North Carolina, proposes this interesting solution to the problem of integration. It's their opinion that the city schools will be better served if men with guns were stationed at the schoolhouse doors to take care of black troublemakers. Does this ring a bell at all? Does this suggest that the great solution to all of our problems in America is just to have more guns? And let's put them in the schools where they really belong. Anyway, Ellis doesn't back down. He goes to the press. He talks about the fact that he's under a lot of pressure not to participate, but he also explains the fact that if he doesn't participate, then blacks and liberals will be able to ram this thing through. Well, you might imagine that C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater don't get along very well. And there's a picture of the two of them in your order of service from the 1970s and then later in their lives together. So they say some pretty nasty things to each other in the first days that they're gathered together. But the idea of the dialogue is to put people together and to force them to talk to each other or talk at each other or talk around each other. And the idea is to keep at it, to talk and talk and talk. It's only 10 days long. But it lasts for hour after hour after hour, well into the early morning hours. And there comes a moment when C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater, after one of the sessions, find themselves in a hallway together. And they are both exhausted. Never discount the possibility of exhaustion creating opportunities. They find themselves together in the hallway. They sit down because they're both exhausted. Ann Atwater is a large woman, heavy. Her life has been placed in danger by the weight that she carries. They sit down and they start talking, I don't know why, about their children. And something becomes very clear all of a sudden or in the course of the evening. They both talk about the fact that their kids have been threatened for participating in this process. That is to say, their parents participating in the process. Both their kids have been criticized because they are dumb or stupid. Both their kids, sets of kids, are in the same school system because, as C.P. Ellis has said earlier, if he could possibly do it, he would have withdrawn his kids from this integrated school, but he can't afford to. So who's in the school together? Who is in the school together? The poor population of Durham, North Carolina, white trash and niggers. Would you like to be in one of those two categories in the South? Well, whether you like it or not, somebody's in those categories. And C.P. Ellis and his kids are white trash, and he knows it. The Klan was so good for a while because it let him become a leader. It gave him status and power. But now he's beginning to feel that the Klan is only good for threatening him. As he's talking to Ann Atwater, it begins to dawn on both of them that they have much more in common than separates them. They have the fact that they want their kids to be brought up in a household better off than their households. They want their kids treated with respect. And they are both ashamed that they haven't been able to provide more successfully for their children. So here is the scene at the end of the evening, or the beginning of the morning. The exalted Cyclops, the leader of the local Durham, North Carolina Ku Klux Klan, is holding hands with Ann Atwater, the meanest black militant in Durham, and they're weeping together. You know what? You couldn't make this stuff up, but it's true. It doesn't mean that everything went smoothly from then on. They didn't become best buddies. Not right away. But once they began to see the identification and the resemblance of each other's life, then they began to understand that they had much more in common than they had ever understood before. And having something in common with somebody else begins to erase the artificial barriers that have been put up. And so the barriers come down. At the end of the 10 days, C.P. Ellis goes by the local Klan office, which he led so successfully, and turns in his keys. C.P., if you hadn't turned in your keys, we would have come looking for them. And you still might get shot, by the way. Change sometimes is not anything we want. At the end of this session of dialogue groups, Ellis says that he has been changed, and probably for the better. But it's probably within that same year that he picks up an empty Pepsi bottle and brings it down on his head with as much force as he can muster. But he not only doesn't succeed in killing himself, he doesn't even render himself unconscious. And so slowly he begins to get the message that he's going to have to live. Even though the freedom that he experienced of crossing boundaries has also set him adrift, because he hasn't have his friends anymore. All the people who supported him, all the people who looked up to him, they're gone. These are the people giving him death threats now. He's not a liberal. The only people who are his friends, well, they're in the black community. Because they're just like him. They're poor. They've been trashed. And they're looking for a better life. So Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis form a friendship. They bring produce from each of their gardens to the other person's kitchen. And this unique friendship blossoms, where so many things don't. Well, I suppose the lessons are obvious. C.P. Ellis enrolls in adult enrichment classes and earns a high school equivalency degree. He becomes the shop steward of the local union. He works at Duke University. The International Union of Operating Engineers is the union. He's elected business manager in 1977. This former Klan leader, elected business manager of the union, beats the black incumbent in a union that is 80% black. For the next 18 years, he works as a full-time organizer, and he's very successful in unionizing and supporting the work of unions. He retires in 1994. Ann Atwater is still a good friend, and she continues her mission of trying to deal with issues of segregation in housing and in schools. C.P. Ellis is asked after his retirement what accomplishment he's most proud of. He answers, "That would have to be the fact that I negotiated Durham's first paid holiday for Martin Luther King's birthday." Some white workers said they didn't like King and weren't going to take the day off. And I said, "Okay, you idiots, go ahead and work on that day." Oh, I know, you know, life is sometimes just too crazy. But it's a good message, I think. And maybe it's as good a message for me as anybody in the room. Because I think over the years, the partisanship has gotten into me and my blood as well. And maybe a certain level of cynicism. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Klan, but growing up in Missouri, I knew people who were. So it's a good message, huh? It's a message about putting people together who you have no reason to expect, reasonable expectation that they will cross lines or change. But because you're desperate, and because you know that if you're going to succeed, you've got to get these polar opposites. The Taoists have an interesting idea, don't they? You draw this circle. And in this circle, you have the yin and the yang, the male and the female, and all other opposing elements. But the circle embraces everyone. It's not conflict-free, this circle, but it holds everyone, ultimately. C.P. Ellis dies on November 3, 2005. A memorial service is held for him at the local funeral home in Durham, North Carolina. The exception to the family-only rule is Ann Atwater, who's been invited because her friendship with C.P. Ellis developed and became so important over the years. Ann arrives first. She sits down in the first row next to the casket holding his body. And then a worker at the mortuary notices her, comes in and says, "Excuse me, this service is for Mr. Claiborne Ellis?" "I know. I'm sorry, but the service is for family members only." "I know that too." Man is very uncomfortable at this point, but he's only doing his job. "Well, are you a family member?" "Yes, I am." "Can I ask how you are related to the deceased?" C.P. was